Hello and welcome to the Screen Composer Studio, a podcast about the musical storytellers behind some of your favorite films, shows, video games, and more. I'm your host, Adrian Ellis. John Wellsman comes from a family that is not only musical, but is practically a Toronto institution. His roots go back to the first iteration of the Toronto Symphony Orchestra, founded by his grandfather, Frank. Though John went on to study composition in university, he found the environment stifling, and instead followed his love of roots and folk music down a different path. He played keys and guitar in various groups, also providing string arrangements for recordings, a skill he lent to other acts including Sarah McLachlan and Lorena McKennitt. But it is undoubtedly his work on Road to Avonlea that John is best known for, a show so popular and successful that it is used as a case study in U.S. film schools and still sees fan conventions held all around the world. In this candid interview, John and I chat about how he came to land his first TV scoring gig, his experiences on Avonlea, and his recent work on a beautiful series of documentaries about the Group of Seven. John is also the current president of the Screen Composers Guild of Canada, and we discuss what it means to hold that position, the challenges facing screen composers today, and the hard work that the Guild is doing to protect our rights and value in the digital age. If you like what you hear, please consider giving us a rating and sharing the episodes with your friends and followers. It really helps us grow and share the stories of these amazing creators. And now, please enjoy this conversation as you let the dulcet tones of John's famous soothing baritone take you away. Mr. President, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Okay, let's do that again.
I thought I would get you with that one, John. Welcome.
Yeah, I was gonna demand El Presidente.
How are you doing today, sir?
I'm fine. Good to see you, Adrian.
And where are you coming to us from today?
I'm back in Toronto in my home studio in the basement here.
Fantastic. Yeah, and the weather's sort of turning now. We've got our first little bit of snow for winter of 2020, and we've all been holed up and locked away for quite some time.
Yeah, we're hunkering down, aren't we? We're still in COVID times, just to put a little time stamp on this.
Yeah, it hasn't come up often on the podcast, but when it does, it's kind of interesting. I figure, we want to make this evergreen, but it is a big part of what we're all sort of dealing with. And there's positives and there's negatives. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk a little bit about where you started from. I mean, I think we've got a really wonderful long list of different stories that we can dig into, but I'd like to start at the beginning, essentially. You were into what kind of music growing up?
I heard a lot of classical music around the house, a lot of jazz. Both parents were musicians. My mom was, she studied at the conservatory, got her ARTC, and played classical piano really beautifully. She was quite a musician. My dad played by ear, never studied, but he was the ninth of nine kids in his family.
Yeah.
But he loved music, and he would be the one playing Ellington and Count Basie, Woody Herman.
Oh, wow.
There was a lot of music.
Right. And was anyone professional, or was it all sort of just for the love of it?
No, it was for the love of it. My mom taught for a while, but she studied with Glenn Gould's teacher, Alberto Guerrero, and talked about actually being outside, waiting for her lesson, being outside the door of one of his lessons, and how they were focused on one little phrase over and over and over and over. I don't know if it was for the entire hour.
Wow.
But she remarked on that as, wow, such under the microscope.
Was Glenn Gould a figure at that point? Was she aware of who that was?
That's a great question. She might have known by then.
All right.
I don't know.
Otherwise, how would you know? Yeah. I mean, that's such a funny story in contrast to, I'm sure, what most of us experienced in those RCM practice room areas where you're waiting in year. When I studied classical guitar, it was in the midst of a bunch of other violin studios. So it was just like 9-year-olds sawing away, murdering cats every direction. It was horrifying.
That's hard on the ears.
Getting a little private performance of Glenn Gould working away to Passage must have been kind of nice.
Yeah.
And this is all happening in Toronto, I should mention too, right? Your whole family's very much in Toronto.
Yeah.
And you are still in Toronto. Your grandfather, Frank Wellsman, would it be fair to say that without him, the TSO, as it is, the Toronto Symphony Orchestra, wouldn't really exist?
Well, maybe fair to say. He founded the original Toronto Symphony back in 1906. It ran quite successfully until the First World War. At the end of the war, I think it was 1918, they folded. It was dormant for a few years, and then it started up again. He gave the charter to I think it was Luigi von Kunitz took over the orchestra at that point. Mm-hmm. And the Symphony Forever didn't acknowledge that original symphony, but about 15, 20 years ago, they sort of rewrote the history and accepted. I mean, it was a happening orchestra. It was at Massey Hall. There were regular programs, international artists. Rachmaninoff played. The second concerto. There's a story, funny story. They were both 36 years old. They seemed to hit it off. They had a German. My grandfather had studied in Leipzig. So Rachmaninoff's English wasn't good. Frank's Russian wasn't good, but they settled on German.
Okay.
And got along quite well. And it was winter, so there was some need for something a little heavy. He came underdressed for the season, basically.
Oh.
So they went out to Holt Renfrew, and my grandfather helped buy him a fur coat. He wanted a smaller one, but Frank said, no, you've got to be more fashionable. You should really get something that fits.
Huh. I wouldn't have thought that a Russian would fail to dress for the winter. I mean, they've got some pretty serious winters over there.
Yeah, good point.
What do you think it is about, like, it just sort of occurs to me, like, you know, you have this double founding, essentially, or this upstart and then a collapse and then a re-emergence of this orchestra. Was there a culture that your grandfather engendered in that, or your great-grandfather?
Grandfather.
Grandfather.
Yeah. I never met him. He died in 1952. Well, I think the truth is he was working with a lot of players who weren't great. I think he had to work pretty hard to pull it together. I think they got maybe a cellist from England, Leo Smith, his name comes to mind. But I guess for a city this size, you know, a city that has its first orchestra, it was a big deal at the time.
I mean, it wasn't, Toronto was still sort of, you know, coming into its own still at that point, I think. I mean, we weren't really the major metropolitan center that would have a big symphony orchestra at that point. That's fascinating. And you yourself studied at the Royal College of Music, and then you did University of Western, which I hear wasn't the happiest of places for you.
Well, I made it through 1 year at Western, Adrian. I'd studied at the conservatory and I guess got to grade 9 or so piano and theory and composition, theory and harmony. So first year Western, it was, by this point I was sort of into roots music. I was performing with a local band in Toronto. So I felt rooted. It was more roots music and folk based than 20th century, but 20th century was totally what they were pushing at that time. So while I got into the theory and composition program, there were two profs only. I looked around and I just thought, what are the chances that somehow what I'm loving writing, they're just not digging, that I've somehow got to get into the 12-tone thing. And I left. It was a big deal, but I didn't stop studying. I migrated to the Gordon Delamont course, which is arranging and composition, 5 books, I think. I studied with Todd Booth. That was probably 7 years of study after that. Wow. So I didn't give up studies, but you know, in retrospect, I think it was a really good move. Mm. I had confirmation on an Avonlea session one day. Jim Mackay, who was then head of performance at Western, I told him that story because you feel a bit sheepish about not completing university. I think that's probably what I felt. And he said, oh no, you were so lucky to get out of there. That stuff they were writing at that time. And I thought, oh good, I made a good decision as a kid.
Wow, yeah. Do you feel any, I mean, you just sort of said you felt a little bit of that sheepishness, of course. And I think that's actually a common theme that comes up a lot with people that haven't necessarily completed or have completed, but just feel like they haven't got the next piece of paper or the next thing that sort of like says, no, you were legitimate. But then on the other hand, there's also a lot of classical musicians that I meet or musicians that have studied classically that sort of feel almost like they're recovering from that experience.
Wow.
So
interesting.
Was that something that you, did you manage to get under the wire before you were too infected by that kind of rigor?
I think I escaped the 12-tone thing. So happily. Mm-hmm. But I remember,
which means you can never compose in that way ever again. By the way, you're not allowed.
I tried it once and I quite enjoyed it. But
there you go.
But no, I was concerned that you could overstudy or whatever. Todd Booth, my teacher, just laughed. He said, "You know, I think you study all this stuff and then you're going to forget about it." And I really will say, I occasionally will remember some technique that I was taught through that course, but it's all by feel. It's all by ear. It's all just feel. It's intuitive. Yeah.
It's more of a way to explain why something might work or maybe to get yourself out of a corner if you've painted yourself into one. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's funny. I used to think that there was some secret to like proper composition that was held within the mysteries of that kind of methodology. Right. And, you know, yeah, it turns out, no, they were just kind of banging away at it and figuring out what works. And if they liked it, they liked it. And we all came along and sort of figured it out after the fact. So, you know, you sort of stayed on the track with the folksy roots-based thing well into the 70s and 80s. When you were part of bands. And so you were with Available Space and you played with Sherry Camp. What was that like for you?
We loved it at the time. Available Space was with one of my oldest friends. I've known him since kindergarten. We're still very much in touch. We have a kind of loose band that still gets together every few months, although not in COVID times. So Available Space, we toured a bit. We went East Coast, never became road rats, but got a really great opportunity, huge opportunity with CBC. They did broadcast recordings back in that time, and you would get an album, you know, budget for an album. First real recording sessions experience in the studio, and serious musicians. We had Murray McLaughlin's backup band. We sort of handpicked a couple of different rhythm sections. And it was an amazing experience. And my first string session conducting, well, helping orchestrate, Paul Mills produced and co-arranged the strings with me. But, you know, that was a first. I never studied conducting, right? I didn't have the later years of university. So I pretended. But it was exhilarating. It was the first big group of strings. And it was funny because some of the elders on the session, or at least one, did say, "So, Wellsman, Were you related to Frank Wells?" And I'm going, okay, wow, it's the legacy thing. This is could dog my trail, because at least the elder knew of Frank. But that was a great experience. And then after that, so Available Space fell apart, as many groups do.
Yep.
But Sherry was the lead singer in that, and was my partner in life. So we kept on, and then it was Sherry Camp Band. So that was, we kind of got a record deal with WEA. It landed in our laps, and honestly, it was a great experience. It was a great opportunity, but not a great experience, because we felt we were just transitioning into something. But at that time, this would have been, I might get the dates wrong, around 80, 82, 81. At that time, Images in Vogue and Men Without Hats and other bands they'd signed. Well, it's the early days of synth pop, synthesizers coming in, and we weren't really that. Right. So, but it was, again, a whole budgeted recording. We recorded at Manta. Gene Martinek produced. We had a great band. I'm still proud of a lot of that material, but the band experience was great. But, you know, I learned we lost that record deal shortly after the first record.
Is that still stuff still floating around out there? Could people find it?
You can find it
online, right?
Sure. Yeah, okay. I'm assuming. Yeah.
Do you think that love and that interest in that kind of music, does that translate into your sound as John Wellsman today?
Playing in a band is a really good thing for a screen composer to do. You learn how rhythm is put together, drums and bass working together, keyboard parts, guitar parts. And yeah, that influenced what I do when I have that kind of arrangement in my scores. Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah, speaking of arrangements, that's sort of what you went on to do a lot of in the following years, working with Lorena McKenna and others. Were you ever thinking of perhaps following the track of becoming studio musician or a professional arranger for bands or a producer?
Studio musician was really originally what I believed I wanted to be. I just thought it was the best. That was what I aspired to. A few years before that record deal, I had done my first film score, 1979, believe it or not.
Okay.
And it was with Kevin Sullivan, and he went on to do The Road to Avonlea and Anne of Green Gables and so on. He and I were classmates from grade 9 to 13. We went to the same high school together. So when he graduated high school and was doing some university, he made a film. I think he was working with Hart House Theater Group or something, decides to make a film, The Fir Tree. And he says, "John, you know, come and do the score." So I'd had exposure to that, even though it was so crude. We were really learning together. But by the time the record deal was lost, I'd learned enough about the film scoring thing that when you do the work and you complete the work, you get paid. Something about the record business was all these details, all these ingredients had to be in place. And the assumption was that you were good. But if one of those items wasn't quite in place, you could fail and you wouldn't get paid.
Huh.
So I very much focused on on the contract work, commission work.
How pragmatic.
Well, I was. I mean, really.
One thing that you've said is, you know, you need to make sure that people know what you're doing. You need to be able to broadcast yourself and you know, not keep it too close to your chest, because that's actually what helped you get your first series for Nelvana. Can you tell that story?
Well, it's kind of hilarious to me as I look back. So I just completed a new reel, and I must have gotten to know Lawrence Schrag through some connection. I can't recall how, but I called him up one day. I said, could I play my reel for you? I'd like your comments. And so I went down to his studio, and we're listening and we're playing, and he's, you know, he's liking it. And then I guess very shortly after, actually Glenn Morley came in during that when I was playing, and maybe Lawrence was playing something of his and Glenn's, because they were partners writing together at the time. And Glenn made some funny comment about Piccolo. And that was my first introduction to somebody who's become a great friend and one of my early mentors, really. But it was after that, Lawrence gets a call, and he's speaking. Okay, yeah, sure. And then he gets off the phone and says, you should send this to Brian Walker down at Nelvana. They're looking for somebody for the Edison twins. So the next day, or maybe later that day, I sent the tape down. And the next morning, I get a call from Brian Walker, who says, where did you come from? This is great. I want you to do this series. And I landed that series without no custom demo, no nothing.
Yeah.
And it was a really good fit. It was and first series was a great, great experience.
Yeah.
That week after week, you know, delivering a show.
Sure.
You learn discipline. You learn cranking it out. There's no time for creative block. You know, it's just, it's craft. Inspiration too, but
something that comes up often in conversations on this show with guests is this idea of not only interfacing with people and how important that relationship is, but especially with the people that have been around a little longer, is how important it was. And they're not saying this directly. It's sort of coming out as I see it as a pattern. You did this in person. So when you did this demo, it wasn't just, oh, here's my music. I've sent it to you and like download it and listen to it on your own, or even like, here, put it into the CD when you're driving home in the car. You were with the person. They knew who you were. Mm-hmm. There was this interaction. There was a personality aspect to it, I'm sure, just as much as it was about the music, for him to be able to suggest that you reach out.
Yeah. I think I took the approach early on that I should meet and speak with as many people as possible. Hmm. I did that when I was leaving Western, because I thought, this is a big decision to not continue with that. So I remember going to live music all the time. I remember speaking with Rob McConnell of the Boss Brass, and he said, just get out, just get the real life experience. He didn't say even continue with your studies with Delamond. I think he understood I was serious, so I wouldn't stop studying.
Right.
You know, to become literate, I think was the right thing to do. But seeing Lawrence, I really love people generally. So I think I would naturally not, can I just send you a tape? I thought, could I see your studio? I wanted to see what his studio looked like.
Right. And, did you have a methodology of going about that? Like, did you have a sort of weekly process, or I will meet X number of people by the time the year is out?
Not at all. Oh. Not at all. And I think I just naturally keep on at it, you know, as time allows. I'm pretty motivated generally. I usually keep if I've got time and I'm looking for gigs. I'm obviously looking for gigs. I've just polished off. I want to hear his comments on my reel. Is it too long, too short, whatever.
Yeah.
So it's a bit like I'm just working to try and connect with the next gig.
What have you started to maybe in part move some of those activities over to the online sphere, or has this been, do you still do it the way that you've always known to do it?
No, I'm more sending stuff for sure in the past couple of decades. I'd always prefer, I hate to send a demo in without having spoken to a director, and at least over the phone, hear voice and hear, I really believe in all that stuff. The speech rhythm, it's the vibe. It's a chemistry thing that you want. I don't want to sign up with somebody who isn't a good person, isn't going to be fun to work with. No, sure. I've had a few not great experiences.
Yeah.
And you invest a bit of time and energy. But if I could go down and meet with the director, of course. And I really don't like the undirected real deed. Oh, just throw some stuff and we'll sure. see if it fits. Like, come yeah. on.
I mean, you have in your roles in the SCGC, you've had probably a lot of opportunities to have conversations with emerging composers. Mm-hmm. Do you kind mm-hmm. of feel for them in terms of the way the world has shifted? Do you understand from their perspective yeah. sort of where, like, because I mean, there's sort of multiple things about it. There's mm-hmm. sort of a more, I wouldn't say prevalent, but more understood, you know, ideas about social anxiety or people not necessarily being good in a crowd or being mm-hmm. easy with walking up to people and striking up conversations, mm-hmm. but also in order to maximize opportunities, also taking things online and trying to work, you know, things yeah. in social media or in the online sphere. Do you have thoughts about how to make that more effective? Because I feel like I often watch people just sort of flailing around.
I do think there's something, I think I've said it to a lot of emerging composers, you know, you've got to be good at the music part.
But sure.
really, it's at least 50% your people skills.
Right.
So if you are naturally not that good with people, that's something you need to work at. Mm-hmm. I think I worked at it.
Yeah.
I think that I'm not naturally a get out there, you know, speak confidently kind of person. I've grown in. I hope over the years, but I wasn't that to begin with. But you know, you get yourself into places that aren't the most comfortable, but try to look at when other people do it well, model yeah. them and
sure.
whether they're going to be official mentors or not, you can observe people at work socially everywhere you go. If you're, yeah, I think you want to be tuned into that. And because I really do believe it's managing egos, it's managing personalities, it's managing expectations.
Yeah.
You're really collaborating. You're getting into a pretty intimate relationship with somebody who don't forget, they've been on their project for how many years? When you think about a director who's developed something from scratch, and
sure.
when it's a more auteur kind of work, it wouldn't be unusual for it to be 3-4 years on for them. When they bring you on, you know, this whole mysterious, it's music. For them, it's probably, I think it's, I've heard from many directors, well, it's the most fun I have in the entire process, but it's also the most nerve wracking because
right.
so much could go better or could not go so well.
Yeah.
You know, so it's really a special relationship.
Absolutely. And so delicate, mm-hmm. especially in those moments yeah. when they are bringing you something that they've, you know, gone to war for, gone to hell and yeah. back for. They've yeah. they've suffered the wounds and the terrible atrocities of all those aspects of pre and post production. And yeah. I think that's sort of like, that's a big mistake I see some people making, is that they make it too much about themselves and what their next bit is, as opposed to sort of like, you know, taking someone in going, you've been through a rough time, have a seat. What can I get you to drink? Like, let's talk about this for a bit and just sort of, you know, get the yeah. temperature going and then yeah. we'll talk about what's
exactly.
next.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
I think another interesting thing about what you were saying about, you know, getting better at the social aspect of it is that you do have to find, and we were talking about this earlier before we started recording, is you have to find your own unique way of doing that. You have to do the Wellsman mm-hmm. way, and I have to do it the mm-hmm. Adrian way, and I have to do mm-hmm. it. You know, each person has to find their own particular stride. You can't pretend to be somebody else and you know, pull off the big shot, arrogant moves or, you know, whatever it's going to be.
Yeah. Very true. I couldn't agree more.
So I wanted to move on and start and talk a little bit about some of the amazing projects you've been part of. Of course, you know, although it's a little in the past, but still one of your best known and most beloved works is Avonlea, or Road to Avonlea, as it's otherwise titled as. Yeah. You know, I mean, one of the most lucrative drama series in Canadian TV history. It was co-produced by Disney. I mean, there are conventions that people still go to, and there are forums online where yes. they discuss all the vagaries of this. It's massive in Japan. It's massive in Hungary. Yeah. You know, this is yeah. a pretty amazing, legacy, a show to be part of. And I even heard that it was, you know, this, it's used as a case study in U.S. film schools as a model
of TV, right?
Yeah, for TV drama that has wow. a wide appeal. You know, I mean, this is sort of like the golden goose that everyone hopes to get, something that's lauded both for its, it's how well made it is. And then it's also mm-hmm. beloved. Mm-hmm. And so this is, you know, you working with Kevin Sullivan, who's the producer, and you've known each other since grade 9.
Yeah.
So yeah. a long-standing relationship. You yeah. were telling me a little bit earlier in the conversation that you worked with him on a student project called The Fir Tree, right?
Yeah, that was our very first collaboration. The second film we did was Krieghoff on the Canadian artist Cornelius Krieghoff.
Right. And there's a funny recording session story, I think, attached to that one, right?
Yes, indeed. So I don't know whose idea it was, but I know, you know, when you want to, we wanted a string quartet. And Kevin said, well, North Toronto students are pretty good. Why don't we hire some students? And then, you know, we wanted a reverberant space. So we thought, well, why don't we record in the stairwell? And I'd love to know if it was my idea or his. But we took a reel-to-reel deck, tape deck, and I guess some kind of playback. But we did sound-on-sound recording, probably recorded them three or four times. And of course, on average, any of out-of-tuneness, which there was some out-of-tuneness in the strings, of course, kind of got averaged out and it was okay. It was live music, though. That was the point. He always wanted live instruments. And funny, putting live stuff on your reel early on. Well, there wasn't so much MIDI at that point. It was just coming on. But it really helped. In early years, I was known as somebody who did live. Like, that was my experience. So those sort of gigs, one gig begets the other. I learned more working with Kevin because he was so steeped in music, and I was pretty steeped in music. And we would trade recordings and ideas for what this might sound like, Jane of Lantern Hill particularly, because that was the East Coast thing that we were starting to look at. And then, you know, we were playing Vaughan Williams back and forth. I found a funny old record. Sir Kenneth McKellar, I can still picture a man, he's a Scottish tenor. My Heart's in the Highland, I think was the title. Very, almost stuffy old Scottish, but man, was it beautiful. And these arrangements and these songs, that stuff really influenced Avonlea. We would point to, well, we quoted them. My Heart's in the Highland was used in one of the closing credits. It was somebody's theme, I can't remember who, but, and with many series, you have fun and with the closing credits. You can step out a bit because there's no dramatic action to track. So I did kind of what I thought was a pretty fun version of it.
What did you connect with in the show? Like, what was there sort of a guiding thematic link to all the things? Was it the characters? What did you find appealing about it?
Well, from the beginning with Avonlea, we knew it was going to be the East Coast thing. It was going to be that general vibe. So Scottish, Irish, British Isles heritage. Mm-hmm. We already knew it by that point. We kind of had that language down, going, you know, themes back and forth. It was very collaborative. I would bring him two or three or four themes, and he'd listen, and he'd comment, and I'd go back, and I'd, you know, polish. And it was never accepted first time. He was a very musical guy. Now, Road to Avonlea, it was so beautifully done. You naturally fell in love with the characters. Young Sarah Stanley, played by Sarah Pauley. Mm-hmm. Well, incredible cast, actually. Jackie Burroughs, just amazing. Cedric Smith. I knew him from Perth County Conspiracy days. And well, I didn't know him personally, but here's this very musical guy. And yeah, he's just... I really related to it. I'm kind of a family viewing guy if it comes right down to it. They were great stories.
Humor. You're probably identifying a bunch of the things that are, in the end, the things that have made it such an evergreen story and an evergreen property to come back to. I mean, now we, of course, got N with an E, and it just keeps going. Yeah. And it's so beloved so popular. It's so amazing.
Yeah.
It feels a little bit like that was kind of a dream gig for you, like that it was such a comfortable and great space to be in. You were able to stretch out.
Yeah, it really was. It was a real gift, but I learned a heck of a lot. Glenn Morley conducted early on. I got working with Glenn. Well, you know, he provided a whole package. He could orchestrate, he could conduct, he'd hire the players, he'd book the orchestra, book the studio. So he was a whole... part of the production machine, really. And we first collaborated on Looking for Miracles and then Lantern Hill again. A show every 2 weeks-ish, 18. Sometimes we had up to 22 players. So you got to know the ensemble. I've always believed in that. Like the Ellington thing was, you know, write for your ensemble. And I had my favorite clarinetist, and I knew that the way I wrote a note, that's just going to ghost in and out. Like just, it's so sublime. Yeah, what those players brought. Virginia Marks, an incredible reedy style flute. I love flute, but I don't love the round fluty tone. And her tone was just beautiful. Doug Miller would later on, he played a similar sort of thing. It was your canvas, and you got to work within a comfort zone, but then meet new characters each week as the series progressed. So it was a constant challenge, but from a comfortable spot.
Yeah.
Yeah, really.
And you were on it for how many seasons?
Six seasons. It went on for a seventh. Yeah.
So it was six seasons. That's 6 years of your life working with Kevin Sullivan on this property. Yeah. And sadly, it doesn't have a very happy ending.
No, it was interesting. It's one of those business stories, actually. So we're going into season seven. And I don't know if it was Kevin himself or his business people around him, but somebody hatched the idea that maybe the music we're recording for this series should be able to be used outside the series. So in any project, any time. And I detected this in the contract where I saw six words missing. For the series. Those six words limited the music to Roe Davenly. When I identified this, I called their business affairs person and said, so is this what, explain this. Looks like Kevin would like to use the music anywhere, anytime. And they said, yeah, that's exactly what he wants. And I madly called. There were other composers in by that point. Kevin was trying other people for season seven. And I called some of my colleagues and we talked about it. I said, This is nuts. It's the beginning of the end, right? Yes, some library music is defensible. We libraried music within Avonlea because if there was 20 minutes in a show, maybe 5 to 6 would be from library, 15 would be new scoring, new themes. Mm-hmm. But that's within a series. But you don't then, as a composer, you're selling the rights to the future shows that you want to actually compose for. So I said, well, maybe for 3 times the price, I'd give you that right, but no. And there was no negotiation. It was very simply. So it was virtually on the eve of a session and they pulled the plug on it. I said, well, I'm going to record anyway because we have to pay the players. It's all done. You can't, and the studio, we can't just cancel and get the money back. And recorded one last session, which I guess was never heard.
Wow. I mean, and I'm sure that was damaging to your relationship with Kevin as well, who you knew since grade 9 and who you'd worked with since the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. It was sort of the end of a friendship for a long time. You know,
a very sad way to end, you know, these 6 years that you've been working on this show to such a claim. How did you manage that? How did you overcome that kind of a loss?
I don't know, but I think what I thought was I really did what I had to do, the right thing. Mm-hmm. And some of my colleagues had already signed that agreement and went ahead and did their shows. But we were all upset about it, no question at the time. It was a tough year that followed. I would just say because Rob Duncan was my assistant at the time, and I remember him saying, we got to get you working again. And it was a period of no work because everybody thinks you're tied up on a series. When you've turned down people who are calling for a TV movie, this and that, and I just go, I'm slammed. I couldn't take on. You're used to sort of people going, oh, that's what he's doing. So it became really almost a year following of I didn't have anything like Avonlea on the reel. Mm. I was trying to just break the pigeonholing that happens. Sometimes people they think, oh, he does that.
Yeah.
And because I wanted to do something very different. And it all worked out. But it was a slow period afterwards.
And just emotionally, did it, you know, I'm sure you had dark days. There, I've had experiences where you think something's such a sure thing, or you think a relationship is so cemented, or you feel that this is, you're just on this path and here the door's opening and all everything's, and then you kind of, you stumble or something goes the other way, or you lose a relationship for whatever reason. And it can kind of put you completely back on your heels.
Yeah. Well, I it's been a long time ago, but I remember it was a time for reinvention and actually, coincidentally, I got very interested in the Guild. I think I was motivated to the Guild. I'd probably attended a couple of meetings in my life, but I felt, let's start to get people talking more. Yeah, for a while, it's kind of funny to say this, but the Guild, my studio was the office. My fax machine was our main means of communication.
Wow.
Because we didn't have email at the time.
Yeah.
And I had the whole fax list of, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 people, and we started building the membership. And so that took some energy too.
Wow. That's amazing.
But it truly was inspired by the injustice of that business deal, right? That was wow. So it was a motivation. It was actually probably a positive thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you have to do. You have to mine for that the silver lining. I don't know. Yeah. Can you mine the clouds for silver? Here I'm going off. I'm mixing my metaphors again. This podcast is brought to you by the Screen Composers Guild of Canada, celebrating its 40th year in 2020. The SCGC is a national association of professional music composers and producers for film, television, and media, whose mission includes promoting the music, status, and rights for film, television, and media composers in Canada. Special thanks to the SOCAN Foundation for financial support. For more information on the SCGC, please visit www.screencomposers.ca and follow us online at Screen Composers. And now, back to our show. I wanted to talk about these wonderful groups of documentaries that you've scored, or the three documentaries about the Group of Seven, about painting and about Canada. Mm. The West Wind, The Vision of Tom Thompson, Painted Land, and Where the Universe Sings. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about how did you get involved with these films? Why were you the pick for these movies about painters in Canada? Mm. And what does it mean to you? Like, what was special to those films for you?
Mm-hmm. Well, they were produced by Peter Raymott, with whom I've worked on many films. His late wife, Linda Lee Tracy, was a director collaborator with me on a bunch of her films, done through White Pine Pictures, their company. Mm-hmm. She developed cancer and sadly left us. But I continued working on with Peter after that. And his new partner, Nancy Lang, really lives and works in the art world. So that naturally became a focus for White Pine Films. They've done a bunch of films about a bunch of subjects, of course. But the Tom Thompson one, just thankfully, he came to me. He's got only a few composers he tends to work with and trust, but he chose me for that. And I just always love Tom Thompson's work. I'm a huge fan. So to get to work on a story like that was a real dream.
I saw The West Wind when it came out. Actually, I saw it on Vancouver Island just by chance. It was out there and I saw it playing in the theaters and I loved it. And I'm also a big Group of Seven fan. And to me, growing up in the West, in Alberta, you know, my dad would come every year from Germany and we would go to the Rockies and camp. And so a lot of, and now it was so interesting for me because that's the landscape I knew. So there was a part of it. I knew sort of the later Harris time and those scenes. And then later moving to Ontario, seeing that landscape, especially because my now wife was from Sudbury. So going up north and of course, you know, it opens up like a canvas of a painting of a Group of Seven painting. You're like, okay, I know this. Why do I know this? Where the Universe Sings, which is the Harris doc, which I thought was so interesting, is that you have this artist that's sort of finding himself, goes to Berlin to learn how to be an artist or the craft of the art, sees the attraction of painting the land and the connection that Germans have to the land, and that you're trying to give people that sense of that beauty and that connection. And it's something that's almost indefinable about why you are connected to a sense of place. And then he comes back to Canada and sort of starts working on landscapes of Canada, and that becomes his main sort of focus. Then he gets into theosophy, and then you know, there's a sort of refinement of his style and how he's sort of creating all these things. And to me, I'm listening to what you're doing in the score and watching these images and everything. To me, of course, you know, this is like, this is the best thing ever. I'm getting art in every level. I'm getting the visual, the oral, and all the whole thing, and the storytelling and the narrative. What was it like working on that film or those films and being able to respond? Like, were you responding to the art itself? Were you thinking about yourself as a Canadian? Were you thinking about the landscapes you grew up in? What was the inspiration for that music?
Well, it's very much tied in with the love of the landscape. I love that northern Canada, northern Ontario, not northern Canada. Well, and it's still about the story. The Tom Thompson piece, you knew you were going to get big vistas, gorgeous, natural beauty shots, and you kind of have a chance to really stretch out with music. So you're given a pretty open and beautiful canvas. You know, those films all breathed. It wasn't wall-to-wall narration, thankfully, you know, because some documentaries are quite dense. Peter really appreciates music, a good score, and you know, have a music moment and let it really open up. So, so you know, again, a gift to the composer. The Harris film was its own. I kind of can't describe how it came to me, but I knew there was something about Harris's life that was about ascending, making his way up towards some pinnacle of success or understanding. He was a very curious guy. The theosophy thing was a curious thing that he got into, but it was essentially an upward moving scale. Mm-hmm. But more than that, I all I can say is that it harmonically sort of presented itself. It's one of those things where I'm thinking, how am I writing? I don't know where this is. It sounds funny to say it, but I've heard other composers say it. You feel like you're channeling something. It's appearing under your fingers or in your mind, but you kind of don't know what even is this based in. But when I heard it back, I thought objectively, okay, that's it's pretty interesting, good, like the textures and the melody, and it seemed to integrate with the film nicely and the evolution in his work. And sonically, so we chose a theremin as the main instrument.
I was going to ask you about the theremin.
Peter loved the instrument, and it was a sci-fi kind of instrument of its time. we were going to have a live player on it. But the closer we got to the final, I just thought, you know, with a decent sample in Omnisphere, it's a pitchy instrument as it is. Let's just go with the sample. So we did.
Yeah, it's a really interesting element. It creates a character around the music that sticks with you and sort of makes it really much a part of that story and that the feeling of what the movie's all about. One thing I sort of wanted to interject here just slightly, because we're talking about, you know, we've got a series like Avonlea, and you've done a lot of other series and big, you know, like Franklin and Friends was the huge animated series you worked on. Yeah. But you sort of came to working on features a little later. You worked on a lot of documentary and series. What was the reason for that?
I think it was because I'd say there was a time in production Canada, the TV movie world was becoming many producers, many chefs. And I recall some projects having three or four people in the room, all with not always aligned ideas on what the score was supposed to be. And I remember that being one of the most stressful things. I think you must agree, Adrian, as screen composers, we are sensitive people. We have to be sensitive, or we could never do what we do to complement and sort of embellish and amplify and subtly highlight the stories we're given. So that kind of stuff would really tear me apart. I just found it so stressful. So I think what naturally happened, you know, you sort of, that thing, you sort of put it out there that I think I want to do this more now. And it happened quite organically, but I was working initially, might have been Ingrid Veninger, one of the first ones, a real auteur, you know, somebody who has their own vision.
Yeah.
They've nurtured a baby to this point, and it's not a multi-chef stew we're talking about. You're really dealing with one creative mind. And I find that just so much more satisfying. So I think that's been the reason the features came a bit later.
It's a very different thing. I mean, as you say, you are working with a smaller complement, if not just a single vision that is being laid out. I mean, that can be good and bad too. I mean, there are times when it's very hard to get inside someone's head or to build that trust with someone, again, who's worked on this thing for such a long time and has such a specific vision. Sometimes it's very hard to get them out of, you know, a single track where you're going, you know, if you keep going down this way, it's just not going to work. Like, you have to understand there might be other options for this, but they're, you know, that's that balance, you know?
Yeah.
What do you think made it work between you and Ingrid, who's a fairly well-known auteur, you know, director in Canada? Mm.
Natural. There's been a lot of trust. I've known Ingrid socially for many years before we worked together.
Right.
You know, I can work with it. She's headstrong. She really knows what she's looking for. And when she's not hearing it, she'll let you know. But that's good. That's clarity. I like clarity. Yeah. But I found there's been a natural trust and we really enjoy each other's company. So it's been good. I haven't worked with her a few years, but
does she allow or push you to do things that you wouldn't otherwise do?
I would say so, but in a good way.
Yeah.
Looking for some interesting instrument that I'm thinking of the limb salesman now. We settled on the VL. You know, it's an early version of the violin.
Oh, yeah. Right. With the, it stopped, right? It has the stops on it?
It doesn't have frets. Oh, okay. It's, no, it doesn't. But it's all played in first position.
Oh.
Although I had Chris Verrett play it. He played beautifully. And I had a sample of the VL, but we used one live one and then the rest were sampled behind. It has this beautiful, austere, really interesting sound. And it's a bit hard to tune up out of first position, which I had him do. Like I was just writing a melody like I was writing for a violinist. And he looked at me like, yeah, I'll try this. He did beautifully. It just really, really sang. Wow. But that film, for those who've seen it, I mean, it's just so moody and quirky. And it was a dystopian future set in the future. And to have an instrument like that, I mean, Ingrid was just searching for character. And I'm looking for that too. You know, we search together.
Is there something that you're most attracted to in the work that you're looking to do next? Do you kind of go out there looking, go, oh, well, this is the kind of thing I want to do. And if so, what is the next thing for you? Do you have an idea of like, this is the next John Wellsman dream project?
I find that whatever I'm doing, I like to do something different next. Mm. So I'm currently working on a score that is very piano oriented. Mm-hmm. Multiple pianos, in fact.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. It's fun. It's a multi-dimensional sort of pianos, and there are other textures and stuff involved as well. Voice, my secret weapon, Sherry Camp sings on scores from time to time.
So you were elected as the president of the Screen Composers Guild in 2015.
I was.
Yeah. Did you miss the news?
No, I noticed that.
I mean, was that something you were expecting? Was there sort of a runway up to that point where you knew this is coming? Was it something that you were looking to do?
No. let me think about it. No. No, I really never imagined I would be president. It just wasn't. I always was preferred working in the background. I loved being on the executive or on the board. I think ever since it kind of got rekindled in 96. I don't know when it officially became where I became a board member, but no, I really love the guild and I love the collegiality and the people, but I didn't see myself as the leader. But nobody else really wanted it, and I understood everybody had really good reasons, and we did have a very sharp group of younger composers, yourself being one of them, who were coming up. I basically had the assurance that, you know, this is a team effort and we're not going to stop doing the stuff we're doing, which I would characterize as the heavy lifting. And I thought, sure, okay, let's try it. But no, I never imagined. But, you know, it's funny, you know, Glenn would ask, are you enjoying it yet? And I go, yeah, it's starting to be fun. It's okay. It's okay. It's not
the,
bad.
The robe doesn't feel as heavy as it did in the first little while. Yeah.
No. And I will say when you get the sense that you may actually be moving the needle, it's tremendously satisfying.
All right. What was your conception of what a president is when you started? Because I know that when I started, when I joined the guild in 2007, I basically started volunteering right away. And then I think it was in the early 2010s somewhere that I, you know, Victor Davies, of course, came and headhunted me just as he does everyone else and said, you should be on the board. And I said, what does that even mean? I had no concept of that. And I'd never been on a board. I had no concept of or even knowledge of what a board did or what an executive was. So, back to my question, which is, what did you think a president was and how's that changed for you over the years?
I don't necessarily think, oh, the guild is going to all sort of align to the president's vision. But in a subtle way, I remember Richard Bellis saying, you're a traffic cop. You know? And I thought, yeah, you know what? But in that, Adrian, I think of it as very much what it always was for me is if you have an idea and you're involved and you don't even need to be on the board to have an idea and get involved and make it happen, things will happen. There's the support there. There's the infrastructure behind. And I think I've been blessed with two amazing boards during this time, really engaged individuals. And it's kind of like winding them up and letting them go and watch them flourish because that's what I actually have come to think that at least my kind of leadership is get out of the way a little bit and let those things happen, because there are a bunch of amazing minds there. It's funny, years ago, I'm suddenly thinking of Seton McLean, who was one of the principals at Alliance Atlantis. He just would wind you up. You would do a spotting session. I'm thinking of Twilight Zone now. Wind you up and let you go, literally. And I remember saying, you know, I really appreciate your trust in me. It's just great to feel like you can be creative and not be, you know, limited in some way. And he said, I believe everybody does something really well. And so why would I not let them do the thing
that's great
they do well and I encourage them? Yeah, it really stuck with me. And I look around with amazement at some of the people on the board and what they've been able to achieve. So if I can say I've had a role in encouraging and helping that flourish, I'm very happy with that. Mm. But recently, as you know, it's turned into something a little different because we didn't really know about the coming of the streaming reality and downstream revenue challenges and all that stuff. So it has morphed into something I hadn't seen at all.
It seems that we've moved into one of the most busy and intense times, and there are so many more initiatives and so many more challenges that seem to crop up on an almost daily basis. And I know one of the things that I don't know if if struggle is the right word, but something that we've maybe not been able to be as effective with is letting the membership know what it is we're actually up to and what it is we're working with, because literally we're just dealing with it sort of up to our hips on an almost daily basis. So we work with a number of different organizations, such as the MCNA, which is Music Creators North America. We've got CM, which is the sort of, you know, Global Creators Alliance, EXA, Traveling. We've got Accord in Canada, which deals with copyright and other issues with creators and publishers. There's been the copyright review, the broadcast review. We've been dealing with things like, you know, those notoriously named FANG companies, which I think is one of the more brilliant branding decisions ever made, which of course stands for Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. Yeah. Safe Harbor Stream. I mean, it just goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
What do you think has been one of the biggest themes or things that you would want to relay to people in terms of what our activities have been and what's sort of the most top of mind thing for you right now?
I think it still has to be becoming better educated about the rights and so on that we're being asked to give away. And that involves an investment of time for somebody who's just at the start of their career, trying to get the music together, trying to get the craft together, all that stuff. Yeah. And wouldn't they rather just leave the right stuff to, you know, the SOCANs and sort of let it happen. And as you do move up ahead in your career, you start to realize how important all these other things are, that downstream revenue. When you get your first series and it's on a decent broadcaster, it's a livelihood now. I can actually make a living and think about having a family and maybe, you know, buy a car. I think that's one of the hardest messages is to get across. I don't know. We just keep on trying.
What do you think one of the biggest current like existential threats to what we do is?
I think it's the downstream revenue component that's threatened by the streaming, the AV streaming reality. And yes, I know AV streaming royalties are increasing. So can, you know, proudly states that, but it was such a precipitous drop from what we were seeing from regular traditional broadcast. Even 100 or 200% increase isn't going to work. It's just not viable.
Yeah.
I think it's a pretty existential thing. I mean, the expression I would go to would be, well, we're going to have a bunch of hobbyists and people who work at other jobs and then do what we do full time, you and me, in the evenings or something. And you know that what that means is the end of the professional class of film and TV and screen composer. I don't think that's exaggerating. I think a lot of our colleagues know that's what we may be facing.
We had the opportunity to go to Berlin for Berlinale in February of this year, just under the wire of the coming pandemic, with Music Publishers of Canada and some wonderful composers and songwriters, and of course some members of our own board. And we heard some pretty amazing and terrifying stories out of the EU copyright directive and their efforts to get that passed. Does it strike you sometimes that we collectively are facing a kind of Goliath and we are the David that's attempting to sort of overcome this enormously powerful enemy?
That is a good and accurate characterization of what it is.
What was one of the stories that stuck with you from that whole trip?
Mickey Mürzer of Germany saying he received a death threat.
Oh my God.
So he was one of the prime movers at EXA, European Composers Songwriters Alliance, lobbying hard the members of European Parliament to please do the right thing and pass this directive. And it was years in the making. We know the leadership from EXA and the people over there worked really hard for many years. But at the end, Google... some incredible revelations. Maybe John Phelan, the International Music Publishers, his speech to the group talking about some of the underhanded, awfully aggressive campaigns that, that Google brought on. I think it was mainly Google. Traced back to, misinformation and mischaracterization and the amount of money that they spent combating it. $30+ million. I've heard up to $200 million in terms of the long-term battle, but whatever the number, hard to imagine, but we won. I mean, the creators did win.
Yeah.
The European directive isn't implemented in every individual country now. That's the next step. But the fact that somehow I think the forces for the right were victorious over all that bad campaigning, is cause for hope. Hearing stories about how they learned before the vote, the MEPs, members of European Parliament, learned about how they were being abused, bad information and that kind of thing, that they actually go, you know what? There's something not right about this. We should vote this other way. This seems like...
Yeah.
So maybe it backfired. Maybe that's what happened. But I think as our vice president, we're very much focused on exporting and rather, I guess it's importing into Canada, the main features of that copyright directive. It would be a huge win to move that forward. And something as simple as recent news in the U.S. that the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, I'm not sure if they call it the same thing in the U.S., but senator talking about re-examining the safe harbors in the U.S. And you think, well, if they're talking about it there, maybe we should be talking about it here. And just so people know, the safe harbors are those exceptions that were put in place at the beginning of the dawn of the internet when we didn't really know what the beast was. We didn't know what it was going to turn into, but they didn't want to be responsible for the copyright materials getting to the user through their pipelines. Well, we all know now they've grown very big and very wealthy on the backs of many creators. And I'm not talking just music creators. I'm talking the larger production, AV production community. And I think it's time that they pay their fair share. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of optimistic that we might actually change this.
Do you consider the arguments from the other side? So for instance, consumer rights groups being concerned that they're going to be charged more because creators have to get paid, or anti-copyright lobbyists saying that having strong copyright infringes on personal freedoms and the ability for people to express themselves or come up with new inventions or drive the progress of culture forward. Do you have thoughts from that sort of devil's advocate's side?
I know that people I talk with, regular music users, appreciate that they're getting music for a fraction of the cost they used to. They're not getting AV content for a fraction of the cost, even though I think the Netflix deal is sort of unbelievably reasonably priced for the amount of material you're getting.
Sure.
Think back a few years to, renting DVDs at the local shop, what we'd spend in a month if you were a fan of movies or TV series, and think back to what you were spending there. And
then just a cable package.
Exactly.
Cable packages would easily run you into like the several hundreds.
Yeah. So there has been a reduction, and that's, I guess, the competition between these companies trying to come online and be the first and be the biggest, be the best. But I think to the music, somebody the other day said, if you think about your percentage that you're listening to music and taking it in compared with the percentage out of your, let's say, entertainment dollar that music represents now, the output, it's way out of whack. So I do hope that people will recognize, and it's a challenge for all the music producers out there, the music creators, but they'll recognize we're starving a source of great entertainment that we all love. It's being crushed out slowly. The faucet's being turned off. It's a huge campaign to get the user to believe that. But I believe the user, if it's presented properly, will recognize we have to pay more. But that may be dreaming. I don't know.
Obviously, it's unrealistic to expect every creator to suddenly march with us to the front lines and become actively engaged and involved in every single thing that's going on. But what would be one thing you wish more people did to be engaged or more involved?
Well, it's kind of what we're doing right here. And it comes more easily to me than it did a year ago, even 2 years ago, because I'm talking to politicians more and government people more recently. But you kind of have to have a bit of a speech that gives your friends, if you're sitting around a dinner table sometime, and they all love to hear your music, you know, and you've released a new album where you've, well, it's been a while, but you've done a live gig and people are so... But to recognize the value that music has and talk about it. I'd like to think that if government hears what's really going on in the arts, the music creator community, the truth, that they are real and caring people, that they'll do what they can, you know, legislatively, whatever, to protect, you know. But I think it really helps if on a very basic level, you can talk to your friends about it in those terms. Talk to your relatives about it in those terms. It's just a very grassroots approach, but that's the start, right?
Yep.
Yeah. And then it turns into writing your MP and making a few sentences that make sense, that motivate, that, you know, win hearts and minds, I guess. Mm.
The Screen Composers Guild is now in its 40th anniversary year. So you remember 40 years. And in the last little while, we've seen a lot of change, in all ways, not just to do with the industrial aspects, but also with things like we had our gender study done, which was quite shockingly revealing. But I think what we kind of knew just sort of by going to the events, sort of what we knew was true, that this is very underrepresented in terms of women in the industry. We've got our diversity initiatives coming out now. And we've also got the Composer Rights Initiative. What's your feeling in general about where the Guild is at now? Do you, and about where we're headed? Do you feel positive? Do you feel concerned? What's the state of John's mind in this regard?
I am an optimist by nature, Adrian. I think maybe you know this. I think with all the challenges, I really believe in this group. I really believe in the creativity that we all bring to the table. And I won't say it's just the board. It's the entire guild when we get together socially. You know that there's just a certain attitude about all these things. It's been fantastic to see particularly Janelle Bechtold and some of that committee, which is called the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee. I mean, to see that start to take shape and it'll inform policy, I'm really proud of the fact that our board is becoming more gender equity. We're about to appoint 4 great new members as officers for this last year before this board's mandate is up. I guess, you know, I just feel we're moving in the right direction. Am I optimistic for the Guild? Yes, 100%. We've got a lot of motivated people working really hard, particularly the Composers' Rights Initiative. The idea is very simply that if you're a Canadian producer and you're going to access the Canadian tax credit system, i.e. public money, that you don't take the IP rights, you don't take the music rights from your composer. You allow them to retain ownership and benefit from that. Mm-hmm. And that's through the CAVCO certification, Canadian certification system. It would be a simple mechanism. So it's brilliant in its simplicity. Whether it's ever actually passed, I believe what we're on, that we're on the path towards a collective bargain with the Producers Association, CMPA. Wow. We're the only key creative who doesn't have a collective bargain. And why that is, how that is, you know, we could debate forever.
Sure.
But we have been lone cowgirls and cowboys in our negotiations. We don't have much power when in those negotiations. Mm-hmm. And I think what's happened is this erosion, this getting to this point where people feel, producers feel, even for the lowest budget project, oh, and we're still taking your copyright and your publishing rights. And you think,
right,
ah, it was always a negotiation. In fact, I say it all the time when I'm speaking with government. There was a time when I started out, because I've been around for a while, when it was never asked, ever even talked about. It was a license you signed, master use license and synchronization license. So it's been a gradual erosion that's just caught up with us. And it, as you know, it was earlier this year, just prior to the COVID shutdown, when one of our members was looking at a probably 1/5 a normal budget. And the producer saying it's a take it or leave it proposition. That's called coercion. You know, when we were in Berlin and we were all hearing these speeches from the various people we're just talking about and others who spoke, coercion, you know, it's a strong word, but Adrian, it's really that kind of gun we have felt to our heads. If you don't play by these rules, you lose the gig. Or we'll just go on and find somebody else. And we do have a lot of people who would like to do music for picture. So that's a bit of a supply and demand reality thing. But
yeah.
But I believe no matter what, we're on the path to the some kind of agreement with the producers. And that'll be a very important agreement because we'll get some baseline things in place.
That would be an absolute landmark,
I think its time has come, and this Composer Rights Initiative is either a motivator or a, you know, a stepping stone towards that.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you're still on a positive track, because it's been, I think it's been a heavy, you know, almost two terms now for you and the things that we're dealing with. And it certainly seems unprecedented. So I'm glad that you're still feeling positive. And I certainly agree with you that it's, it's largely due to the people that we have around us and that are directly involved in the membership itself. That is, you know, so wonderful in this community that the Guild has fostered. I think it's one of our most precious resources for sure.
It truly is.
So what's next for John? What are you working on these days? What are you excited about?
Well, I have been working on my guitar playing. I've met one of the world's great luthiers. She happens to live in my neighborhood.
Oh, well.
Linda Manzer. she had this beautiful guitar that had a funny story, and it was lying dormant for a long time under somebody's bed. It's been essentially rebuilt. And last fall, she lent it to me.
Oh, wow.
And to have a chance
that
to
play. That was a sneaky move.
Oh, it's just... Well, she was hoping I'd play it because it would help open it up again. And I did. I didn't play it daily, but I played it almost daily. And to play a really beautiful instrument like that, it kind of rekindled my interest in the instrument. And then the COVID reality, you know, a little more time on our hands, less gigs for sure. So I've, you know, I'm working on my guitar.
And that's awesome.
I don't think about the notes or anything. It's all just strength in the fingers and a little better technique. I've been inspired by people like Richard Thompson, seeing him live, and just such a tremendous Sean Colvin, tremendous strong guitar players, and I just love the instrument. So I figure, get better at something. Why not?
Yeah, go deep. That's great. Yeah. Wonderful. John, where can people find you online and follow your work if they're interested?
I think it's wellsmanmusic.com. Yeah, there's samples on the website. And following music, I don't know, you can listen to a fair bit of stuff there. But I hope there'll be something new. I didn't mention, but Sherry and I have been working, co-writing, and mostly her songs, actually, a CD, an album.
Oh, wonderful.
She's been working on songs for years, I mean, in the background. So some of these would be 8-10 years old, even. We might be re-recording something from even 20, you know, longer ago. But it's just been, maybe it's a COVID project a bit, too. But there's been time to focus on this stuff. And in a way, it feels like returning to where I started, because I was first writing songs and performing live. And it feels like a bit of a, I've always loved songs and finding, you know, the right arrangement around a story, around lyrics.
Yeah.
In a way, it's the same as film scoring. It's just with that voice there, you know, speaking words.
Well, yeah. John, thanks you so much for joining me today. It's been super fun chatting with you and hearing all the stories. And of course, you know, you and I have been working together for a long time, and it's always been fantastic, you know, being on the road with you and everything. And I hope we can do that sometime very soon again.
Yeah, I look
forward to it. And get out there and keep fighting the good fight for the Guild and doing what we do.
Indeed, we will. Thank you, Adrian. It's a pleasure. I knew it would be a fun conversation to have. All the best.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, please consider showing your support by giving the show a 5-star rating and sharing the episodes with your friends and followers. The Screen Composer Studio is produced by myself, Adrian Ellis. Graphics and post-production assistance by Nick Grimshaw. Special thanks to our managing director, Tanya Dedrick, as well as Charlie Finley, Elizabeth Hannon, and Gagan Singh for their support. For more information on the SCGC, please visit www.screencomposers.ca and follow us online at Screen Composers, or reach out at tscs@screencomposers.ca.